Colonel Collins, Rail 13. We were still talking about some of your experiences, probably in the Gothic line, but you don't know what, when exactly or where exactly. Two more incidents you have in mind.
Yes. Well, the other incident, I mean, I'm not going to mention it because it sort of illustrates how fatigue and tension, you know, can play tricks on the imagination. I was sent on a probing patrol on one occasion, and it was uncertain whether the enemy had withdrawn. I can't remember exactly what it was, I said. And it was only meant to last 3 or 4 hours or something, but anyway, in the event, it went on all night, to cut a long story short. And I and the thing was, because I got really absolutely stuck in a place or two, when, you know, we got into the area where clearly the gentleman had been, because you can always tell by the smell of their anti-lice powder or whatever they use. You know, they're very distinctive. And then, curiously, I came across a ruined building. A building had been obviously hit by a shell fire or something like that, and it collapsed. And it had a large beam, a structural beam, sticking up in the air for all the world, like the barrel of a gun, but quite a field howitzer, you see. And in the sort of half an hour, maybe it was night time, I'm not sure what and how much moon there was, but I absolutely froze, and my chaps behind me, we were not a fighting patrol, we were just about three of us, lightly clad and lightly equipped, and we just cringed into the ground, and stupidly, really. I mean, the last thing that would have been there would have been a manned howitzer, quite honestly. But I was so, you know, tired and confused, if you like, that I wasn't able to rationalize it. And I imagined that I could see figures moving and I could hear them talking, and so I was actually, clinging to the ground, inching forward to try and get better. And, of course, I'm really terribly. You've seen a cat breathing tons of a bird, haven't you? Well, rather like that. And but it went on a long, long time, and this happened 2 or 3 times on that evening, so we were very, very late getting back. But of course, in the end, it became clear it wasn't anything there at all. And they made me think of those lines in some of the poems of Shakespeare. You know, at dream of night, imagining some fear, how awful is a bush. But anyway, it took us so long, and this was in Johnny Preston's time, I'm pretty certain.
So this would be, before this be...
Yeah, I think it must have been. Because I seem to remember that I don't think he actually lost faith, but people thought that I had last bought it and got lost, you know, or failed me to put in the bag or something. Because we didn't come back until well after first night. Then we came back and saw another company's line. And thought we would, you know, it's been stealing somewhere or other. So that was that little incident. But it was just a little illustration of the mental thing. And the other thing is the matter of fate, if you like, the chance. Alan Hay, who was my company commander on and off, on one occasion, I was his leading. And we gained our objective, and it was a farmhouse, and I made it secure, and then I found in the back of the back room and a bit of a camp bed, you know, and I thought, right, it was still an headquarters here, you see. And so I set myself up in there and had this bed already. Everybody else had their bedding or their blankets just lay on the floor. Anyway, then Alan turned up with his company headquarters. Ah, he said, well, thank you very much. Very nice company headquarters. Of course, there was nothing I could do about it. So he pinched my nice billet. So I said, well, you know, I've got to say, oh, he said, well, you can stay here. He said, but anyway, thanks for the bed, you see. Anyway, he set himself up on his bed and he said, well, we're all right here, Colonel. We're all right here unless a shell happens to fall in that doorway. Anyway, so we all lay down on the floor. And it wasn't long before the shell fell in the doorway. And poor old Alan, because he was up on the bed, he was the only one above ground. Shell splinter came and went through his hand. And you know, Lucy Hens, what's the word, this disabled, only slightly, but to this day, you know, that was a Shell's business, it really had my number on it, and he loved it, and it wasn't. And that's what happens.
Just one final point, just to make sure, because some of the things, so it wasn't Alan Hay that was the company commander that left you in the lurch.
No, certainly not. No. He was the one who brought the splinter. But
I'm just making that. Now, one more incident.
The final one that comes to mind, and again, it's a terrible situation, and again, part of the fog of war. But I can't remember where this was, but I think this was in the country. It was on the train when I was sent on my platoon sent on a fighting patrol, if you like, to go to a particular, as part of a general move, and we were to go across a certain river and to explore the enemy presence in a particular, there was a wooded knoll, and over the night we set out. And of course, the first thing was when we came to the river, the bridge had been blown. And it was chancy whether or not we could have crossed. But still, we managed to pick our way over the whole nation, get to the other side. And then we identified this objective and moved up towards it. And as we approached the thing, we started going up the hill among the trees. And it began to be. Get the feeling that, you know, that we were, that it was occupied and we were being surrounded. Whether we heard noise or not, I couldn't remember now. And the two things in particular that I remember that I wanted to mention. One was the calmness of somebody, and sadly he was later killed, but Sergeant Price, we were crawling forward, and some people are very jittery. You see, people are very different from this, very differently. And some behave quite wildly. They become very erratic, like that man who shot at me, you know. Anyway, Sergeant Price, who was a splendid Yorkshireman, he was just sort of a few yards to the right of me and perhaps a yard or two further forward on that flank. Between us and behind both of us was another lot of soldiers, you know, another part of the later section or something like that. And some idiot there, you know, seeing our silhouettes crawling in the front, assumed we were the enemy. So without any orders, open fire. And he hit Sergeant Price. Luckily, only a flesh wound. You know, but a 303 or a 300 bullet going through your arm is no joke. And Sergeant Price turned around and said, "Hey, steady on, you chaps. What are you doing?" Amazing, isn't it? And but then it became apparent then, I mean, that alerted the Germans as well and so on, and so I thought, this is bad news, you know, there's no doubt they're here, we're in trouble. So we got, I gave the order to get to the foot of the slope. It wasn't a very steep slope. And when we got to the point where we'd entered this slope, looking slightly to the left of the line on which I'd been advancing, I suddenly saw the flash from the front of the machine, from the muzzle of the machine gun, which I came to know a lot about afterwards, by the way, because I was working on flash suppressors in the Ministry of Defense. And this was very much in my mind. And I saw the flash of his machine gun, and he fired a burst across our front. And I mean, there's no way me pointing out to somebody else that. I mean, I'd seen it. So I called the nearest machine gun. I said, "Come on, give me your gun." And I got down, and I had a clear picture of where this flash was, and I knew that was the muzzle of the gun, and I worked out how far behind that the crew would be, and I let off a long burst, you know, just that distance behind, and I heard no more from that machine gun. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that you just have to think through, and it's usually going to, and I can remember that, and see it as clearly now. I don't remember being aware of it, you know, being in the open, as it were. We've been in the line continuously, and just bands on the body area. And then suddenly word came through that we had to be relieved in line and assemble cake transport and go down the country. And I'm not sure if we were told at that point even that we were going to Greece. But the thing that fits in my mind is that we didn't have time to get loaded, and I remember one of the things we loaded, we just shortly beforehand, we opened on a wine factory, and all our 4-gallon water cans, which we had in our window, we filled them up with vermouth and Marsala, the thing that sticks in my mind that made such an impression on me was that we flew, and of course that was flying, troop flights were very uncommon in those days, by troop ship. The battalion flew from Rome to Athens, those two principal historical capitals in the day. I think it was on the 3rd of December. I remember that move. That's about what happened.
Did you know why you were going to Greece?
Well, it's hard to say now, because I know now why we were going to Greece, and it's hard to say how much one knew at the time. I think we were just aware there was some sort of disorder there. The Germans had gone, and that there was some sort of a communist attempt to take over the government. That's what we inferred, as it were.
Now, when you got there, I believe the battalion went to the Acropolis area first. Do you remember?
Yes, I had a platoon. I had a machine gun position on the corner of the Parthenon. But the thing was, the situation was very confused, because at first, you see, there were people wandering around carrying weapons, and this was a, as it were, a civilian, ostensibly a civilian and peacetime, or at least there was no armed enemy there. And there were people going around the streets carrying weapons, and I remember initially we were trying to capture these people, and I remember, chasing somebody across the street and sort of thing to try and disarm them. That was a futile gesture, really.
Was there any actual shooting at that stage?
I can't remember at that very early stage, no. I remember on one occasion, there was some, yeah, but not against us. I remember there was an incident, for example, where I was involved, because there had been some sort of a shooting incident in the street, and there was an angry mob around. And one didn't know at all what to do. We had really no rules of engagement or anything like that. And so I determined the only way to deal with it was by a sort of show of strength. And so I fell in my platoon in the very conspicuously in the street, went into open order and ordered them to fix bayonets. And then we marched briskly down the street to where this mob was. And of course everybody just melted into the sideline. And then there were people there weeping and wailing over a man who had been shot through the head. It was obviously a sort of, an assassination of some sort. And then we were so thanked by the people. They offered us wine to drink, which turned out to be Red Zeno, which we'd never had before. And Red Zeno has got a very, very bitter taste, as you probably know, of Red Zeno. And I thought we were being poisoned. And I declined to drink it, which was very embarrassing. But still, so I remember one or two little incidents like that initially, but the thing didn't really settle down for a while. And when it did, we found ourselves on the Piraeus Road. The road to Piraeus.
So you fell back from the Parthenon?
That's right. We continued.
Did you? You didn't come under attack, that machine gun post up there, though?
I mean, there was no armed at that stage. I don't remember there being, as it were, organized. But we did establish outposts around the city, and then we moved back to the to our billets along the Fallon Road, or from Fallon to Pineapples. And that was when the battle hotted up. It was clear then. It was a sort of precursor, if you like, of the sort of thing that happened in Belfast, in the recent past. And I often reflect on that looking back. It was probably The first occasion, to my knowledge, when there was a civil disturbance of that kind, where you see in the old British, in the old under the old British Army duties in aid of the civil power, if the police called in the military to help, then you couldn't by influence restore the situation, then. And a mob was formed, then the thing was that the riot act was read out and called upon people to disperse. And after that, it was open, it was open season, as it were, and the ringleaders could be shot. But this was quite different from that, and it was very, very confusing because the enemy, in quotes, who were these communist rebels, if you like, but I think Ilas was their co-name. But they mingled with the crowd during the day, so of course they knew exactly where we were. But it was the first occasion, to my knowledge, when a charge of jellymite was put into the battalion headquarters, or dynamite or something like that, not Semtex in those days, and there was an explosion there in under the staircase in the battalion headquarters building, which had been put there in a furtive way. Cooks were injured and that sort of thing. But we were very nearly, I mean, it was very difficult. At night, it was, we came under fire and we were very nearly, you see, we were stretched out along that road with our backs to the sea. And it was touch and go, really, whether we could keep our foothold there and gain the upper hand. We eventually did. We had some Greek militia under command, but they're more of a liability than help. So it was a very dodgy time. But then it settled. It somehow we managed to restore the situation.
Well, you actually attacked your position?
Well, I do remember in one situation where we were in a building, one of those buildings there, with a garden on the inland side. And I had some of these Greek militia under my command. And we were staking out this garden because it was infested all round, with Ilas insurgents who were trying to attack us. And unfortunately, these Greeks, of course, they were very, very jumpy and jittery. And they, whereas we would hold our fire, our tactic was always to hold our fire, until you see the whites of their eyes. And because by firing, you just give away your position. But of course, they were loose and off everywhere, and they had a very difficult. So that one little incident I remember, I don't remember many such incidents, but the whole situation was tense over a period of weeks, I suppose.
And you actually suffered casualties in the battalion?
Yes, one very dear friend in particular, a chap called Frank Johnson, was one of those officers, who joined us, if I remember rightly, in the Middle East. Matter of fact, there were a few of us who were quite musical, and we used to sing, in the mess in the evening, just for fun. We used to sing little quartets and things, mainly hymn tunes, about all we knew. But he was one of four of us. Ronnie Chernow was another, and myself, beautiful John, Frank Johnson. Old Frank went out to try and sort out somebody, and one of these NES snipers got him.
How were you getting on with the actual civilians? Were they sympathetic to you, or the ELAS, or the Royalists, or what was... Or could you not tell?
I couldn't say exactly what the... We had some good friends there, and, and some we used... By day, everything was perfectly normal, and we would call on the soldiers with you, and that sort of thing. And that would come with little dishes of jam, which is their way of... or at least a sort of confection, like jam. And that was all fine, but then as soon as it was dark, you didn't know who was friend and who was foe.
Now, your regimental, the battalion rather, history makes reference to various ruses they used involving civilian cover, hiding behind women, children, that sort of thing. Were you aware of that?
I really can't remember now whether I was or wasn't. Certainly, I was aware that one never knew. Who was we used to have some sort of checkpost established during the day to try and control the movement of people. the thing was that people really nearly came through in civilian clothes, and you didn't know. I mean, we didn't have stop and search like they have in Northern Ireland, as far as I remember. I really can't.
Were you searching houses? I mean, were you clearing little areas?
From time to time, yes. I remember when we made the advance forward to clear the city, as it were, finally. I remember we came across a some sort of a warehouse or something like that, and a yard where the ELAD had some vehicles parked, including one of ours, I might say, which they had stolen. But I don't remember doing systematic house clearance. I'm afraid of this.
What's the next thing you remember then? You say that the situation quietened along the coast road, and then an advance began,
that's
isn't
right.
it?
Well, then, short, I mean, the same, we had a little while there, and things got back a little bit to normal. There was an officer's club in Athens, and once a week they had a consignment of beer that came in, and that was a very important event. And the other thing was that in 5 years, there was a Royal Navy destroyer in there, and also a South African destroyer, with which we were very, very friendly with the crew of those, and we would go aboard there and parties in the boardroom there with the South African crew, and my goodness me, the amount of brandy and ginger that they could drink, nobody's business, but still. But then the next significant thing was when we got warning we were going to go up into the Peloponnese, because there was some serious concern there. In other words, Athens is stabilized, but other parts of the country. And I think one of our battalions had already gone to Salonika. Anyway, so we were destined to go to the Peloponnese. Now, I don't know if you know the geography there at all, but the bridge over the Corinth Canal had been blown by the Elas, or could have been by the Germans. Anyway, so we had to go by sea to Patras, the Peloponnese, and we put in one of these converted cargo boats. And we sailed around, and then the big question was what we're going to do, because the Elas were in occupation of them. And then when we arrived there, our brigadier brought off a tremendous psychological coup, because we'd arrived there in numbers, but of course we weren't deployed militarily. They weren't assault craft or anything like that, but just a cargo thing. And we're all in there, I guess, like so much but the brigadier went ashore and called for the local commander and issued him an ultimatum that if they weren't out of the town of Patras by first light the next morning, you know, they would have all hell on Patras by this great army of troops that were in these ships. And this was Brigadier Block, who was a terrific man, and he'd done extremely well, I might say, in Piraeus as well, where they named a street after him, Brigadier Block Street, Brigadier A.P. Block Street. He used to call it Block's Block. And the force was called Block Force. Anyway, he bluffed these chaps into getting out of Patras completely, so we just disembarked in a complete untactical way, you know, non-tactical way. In other words, we would have been helpless if they'd jolly well opened fire on us. And so that was quickly set in the situation there.
Now, they withdrew into the hills, I believe. So what happened next?
I've got some clear memories about that too, because being in command of the carrier, presumably, then, and having, I don't know if we took any carriers up there. Certainly we took motorcycles. We may have taken some carriers. I can't remember having carriers. We had motorcycles, and we had to patrol out and establish posts out, you know, in the countryside, which we searched to make sure there were no pockets of enemy sort of, you know, building up to anything nasty. And I used to go around on a motorcycle, a big 500cc Norton, to these various posts. And the roads were in a very bad condition, and I don't know if I didn't fall off a number of times, I don't know, so I managed to avoid that. And after that, then when we were back in our billets, you know, we had a fairly calm time. The situation was not too disagreeable, really.
And what's the next thing?
Well, next time we went back to Calderon, didn't we? Or back to Piraeus, to Athens. Next single thing I remember was, of course, the death of President... and Roosevelt, who died in about April 45, didn't he? And that was sort of world news. And then, of course, all the talk and speculation was where we were going next. And of course, we were hoping against hope that we were going to be selected to go to Northwest Europe to join the much more glamorous party that was going on there. And we abhorred the thought of going back to Italy again, you know, where we fought two previous campaigns, and that left a lot of our dead. And we envied the chaps who had all the glamour, and in any case, it would mean going home first, you see. And it seemed to be a very much more straightforward show than altogether. So we were hoping we'd go there, but of course, in the event, we were told we were going back to Italy.
And did that worry you personally?
Well, I mean, everybody was sort of depressed about it, or at least it didn't do much to improve morale, as I explained. I don't remember personally being any worse off than anybody else. But I was given a very interesting job, actually, and I only wish I'd kept a diary of the detail now, because I was ordered, when we arrived in Italy, I was to go to the base ordnance depot, and I was to collect the complete issue of Bren gun carriers for, I can't think it was for anything for Italian, I think it was more than that, because we had about, a dozen carriers of my platoon and half a dozen in the motors. And I'm sure I had many more than that. I think it was for the brigade, all the carriers for the brigade. And I had to go to the base ordnance depot, which was somewhere down in the south of Italy, you know, in the Taranto area. And I had the job of getting those carriers from there up to the Po Valley, and by a series of road and rail moves, and it lasted a couple of weeks, and it was a fascinating thing, really, because I had to, you know, take them by road to a railhead, and then they were loaded. We loaded them onto flats, and then we would have to go 100 miles or so by train, and then for some reason it wasn't possible to go on by bridge road or something like that. And so we then would offload them again, and then we'd drive some miles. And I used to career up and down this convoy of things on a motorcycle, which again was hazardous. And if I think back now, I was in more danger then than I was very often. And of course, I've been rather stupid. I drove like the captain, and very nearly fell off a number of times because there were so many potholes. But still, we got the entire convoy up to wherever the assembly point was, and then there the carriers were distributed and so on and so forth. And then I rejoined the battalion, and then we were re-equipping and, you know, getting organized and getting teed up, ready to be told. And of course, mercy of mercies, before we could be put into action anywhere, the war in Europe came to an end.
Now, what kind of celebrations did you have? Because I've seen a photograph of you dressed in trag, as they call it.
Every sort of celebration. First thing we did was rather stupid, because we fired off our mortar smoke bombs from our platoon position against some other position, which was, because they can be seen if you're on the lookout. And we must have had a few cans of beer and a few bottles of wine. And, you know, there was general mayhem for 48 hours or so. I can't remember exactly where that party, that sort of pantomime affair, took place. Whether that was still in Italy or whether we had already gone into Austria then, I'm not absolutely. I don't remember there being a long delay before we moved forward to pursue the enemy.
Were you personally very relieved that the war...
Oh, I was, yes. Oh, absolutely. Particularly as
then, you know, we didn't have to go into action a third time in Italy, obviously. Well, I mean, I think one would have been in the lead anyway, but everybody, there was a great sense you've got to be familiar with the human mind.